My name's Jane Neville and I live down in Wattle Flat, which is about 10 minutes away from Creswick. We live off-grid down in the forest in a mud brick house, and we're on about 20 acres, and we moved in 2012. We escaped from Melbourne. I've seen Creswick change since we came here in a good way. It's become more of an arty community, not in a pretentious way, just genuinely. There's some fantastic artists around here. The object that I've chosen is Billy Bear, and Billy Bear is my darling teddy that I was given when I was born nearly 65 years ago. And he was given to me by very dear friends of my parents. He's now very ragged looking. He has one eye left, courtesy of my daughter, who's now 26. He's a bit moth-eaten around the ears and the feet. He's a cream teddy with one blue eye. He's wearing a blue and cream jumper and pink trousers that were knitted by my grandmother. He is my most precious possession. In 1994, I think it was, we were living in Sydney. We thought we were safe from bushfires. We were in suburbia, but the fire had jumped the river, and all of a sudden there was all smoke. We walked down the road to see what was going on, and a fellow said to us, "Oh, you know, you've stopped up your gutters and everything." We went, "No, haven't done anything." We went tearing back home. By the time we got home, and that was only about a 2-minute run, we heard embers falling next door, ran into the house, and all I grabbed was Billy Bear and a handful of jewellery. My husband still laughs now that I didn't bother getting his golf clubs. And we had to leave, and everyone escaped up to the golf course, and we didn't know if our house was still there. In the end, I think there were about 80, 90 houses that were burnt down that day. Everything next to us burnt down. We were incredibly lucky that we had just some local guys decided to save our house. It started to melt. It was one of those, you know, 1950s clad places, and the sides started to melt. We lost all our garden. Got Billy Bear. I mean, he's been through so many adventures because I always took him to bed with me when I was growing up, and even a bit longer than that. And I took him on my travels. The first time I went overseas was in 1984, and I went across. I was going skiing in Austria, so he came to Austria with me. He became quite a fixture in this little village called Hofgarten, where I stayed for most of the ski season. He was adopted by some of the boys. I've never forgiven some of them, including the boy who then became my husband, because they took a photo of them all with their pants down, mooning the camera, including Billy Bear, hoping that I wouldn't check the photos, because I was in the habit, I'd this is pre-smartphone and everything, and I'd just develop photos and send them home. And thank God I checked, because it wasn't a very pleasant photo. So, he's been on a few trips. My grandmother knitted, she knitted the outfit that he's got on now, and she made a little tuxedo for him for our wedding. And I hadn't even noticed that he was missing for a couple of days. She was a very fast knitter. And at the wedding, my Uncle Laurie, he was the MC, and he was doing a speech, and he started talking about this special man in my life and who was coming along, and I was thinking, oh God, who they dredged up? Who's turned up out of the past? And of course it was Billy Bear, looking all spick and span. But my grandmother, she was amazing with her hands. She was a champion knitter, and I've got a collection of different things that she's made, including dolls. But unfortunately, the clever with your hands gene completely skipped me. It's a given when it's time. Chloe, our daughter, has said no, she wants Billy Bear. I've actually said I wanted to be buried with Billy Bear, but apparently that's a non-negotiable. She wants to keep him and look after him, because she knows how much he's loved. And even my husband's warmed to him over the years, even though he saw Billy was a rival to my affections. He loves him too. it's been a wonderful opportunity just to reflect back on Billy Bear. He is someone that I look at every day, and he has so many memories attached to him. I'm sure he's covered with DNA from years back. But I'm a collector from way back, and anyone that comes into my house knows that that's the truth. But he really is my precious possession.
My name's Carly Gay, and I came to Creswick in 2015. Prior to living in Creswick, I lived down the Mornington Peninsula for 6 years, St Andrews Beach, Rye and Rosebud. And what struck me about Creswick was the beautiful old buildings and the big green oak trees and just all the different colours in nature around the surrounding areas. The object I've chosen for the exhibition is my stone mortar and pestle. I've had the object for over 20 years. At the time I bought the mortar and pestle, I'd become a new mum. It was my first gift to myself to nourish my child. I'd been blockading, which is a form of activism to save forests, where people can camp and lock onto machinery or fly what we called sits, which is sleeping up in a tree to prevent logging. And there was always a mortar and pestle at every camp. And it was a really pivotal time in my life in terms of learning about herbs, just completely changed the direction of where I thought I was going to go. And it is a real symbol for me of that lifestyle and nature, and it's where I really started exploring paganism and herbology and things like that. The camps that I lived in, what was so beautiful about that lifestyle was that there were always people in the kitchen cooking together, and there was always an open fire, and there was always food that was unprocessed, and it really was just such an incredible way to live. It was cold, it was hard, it was tough. We were always in fear and on guard, and you know, some terrible things happened out there, but everyone lived together like a village. It's really what I long for to this day. And there was always a mortar and pestle there because people were grinding seeds and making beautiful porridge, and the memory of the hot porridge on the cold morning up in the trees being pulled up by the rope on a little pulley, and you knew that someone had been down there, some sort of old wise person grinding up the seeds for everyone so that we could remain healthy in the freezing cold. I bought myself this mortar and pestle when I became a new mum nearly 21 years ago now, and I've got memories of grinding up linseeds and flax seeds and almonds and sprouts to put in her porridge in the morning to evoke those memories in me feeling so nurtured. Over the years, I've used the mortar and pestle in magical and medicinal ways. The magical ways that I use it are to grind herbs and resins and integrate different ingredients together to create something new. Medicinally, I use it to create tinctures and poultices. One thing that I do regularly is ginger and comfrey for sprains, and actually comfrey's used for broken bones. The history of comfrey is that it used to be called bone knit prior to surgeries and things like that. People would use that to heal their bones. It has all the minerals in it to do so. When I'm using it, it transports me to another lifetime of being some sort of old crone living in the forest making my little potions. My family are always going on about me and my jars everywhere and my little potions. And it's such a complex item. There's so much history to it. I mean, First Nations people have been using a rock and a grinder forever. And over time, it's been shaped into this bowl. And in paganism, it symbolizes the womb. And it's an object that creates life, it transforms life, it integrates life, it heals people, it feeds people. The rhythmic nature of the mortar and pestle when you're grinding food and turning herbs into poultices is, it's rhythmic and it's repetitive and it's back and forth, and it's like the tides of the ocean, and it evokes the same sort of feeling, that real beautiful calmness of something that's a pattern going round and around. It has a real calming effect on the central nervous system and can be quite meditative at times. I met with a friend prior to this interview, and she talked about how mortar and pestles are usually passed down, the same with tarot cards, in the sense that you pass on that knowledge with the object, and I aim to do so with my own children so that they can use it in the manner that it was meant for and pass it on to their children and eventually one day become an amazing heirloom with an incredible history.
My name is Georgia McGuire. I'm a Wurundjeri artist living on Jandak, which is the country of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung people, and I've been living in Creswick for a few years now. I'm also a wildlife rescue and foster carer in the community, so that's kind of how I fit in. I think the thing I love about Creswick, I have a really strong connection to forests and very green places. I mean, partly because my own country is, you know, ash forests, and even though I grew up in Canberra, feeling like I can go somewhere where there's running water and just be in the bush within minutes from my house, it's part of my way of looking after myself. So the object I am talking about today is a red, yellow and black beanie that's been hand-knitted by my grandmother. It's, it's over 30 years old now, and look, it's probably made of pretty cheap wool. It's a bit rough and ready. It's got a few pulls in it. It's the first thing I go to when I am going to leave the house and it's cold, I will put it on. So it pretty much comes with me everywhere during winter. So my grandmother knitted my beanie probably when I was a teenager. At the time, my grandmother is Aboriginal and was raised by white people, and it probably wasn't until my teens that she really started to get a sense of her identity through connections in our own community. And so that was a way for her to, I guess, celebrate her heritage. And so she would knit. We all had beanies and we all had socks, and she knitted socks and beanies, and she would give them to people of significance. So Uncle Patrick Dodson got a pair of her socks, and that was part of, I guess, living in Canberra in the 80s as an Aboriginal child. I shared a room with my nan, so I had a really close relationship with her. I shared a room with her until I was 11, and also I was really fortunate in that our house, she was everyone's nan, but I grew up in an environment where I was surrounded by quite significantly well-known Aboriginal activists in the 80s. And so I guess this beanie is not only something that's a comfort, it has a really strong connection for me in terms of my identity and my upbringing. It's gone to a lot of protests in its life. So, yeah, it means a lot about not only who I am, but I guess the other thing about it is I'm a practicing artist. Unfortunately, my grandmother's disconnection to her culture meant that she wasn't able to learn traditional making techniques of Aboriginal women from her community. But, you know, she was a kick-ass knitter, and my mum sewed all my clothes, and my auntie made lace and tatting and was a seamstress, and, you know, they were exceptionally talented. And so I guess it's not only, I guess, a connection to my family and my identity, but it's also reflective of the fact that I come from a long line of makers, women makers. I'm fortunate enough that I've had other Aboriginal women who are able to teach me skills and techniques that I've been able to include in my own art practice. I think for my grandmother, she grew up in a very small town, and the town's got some really interesting stories for a lot of things, but I think for her it was safer not to identify as Aboriginal, particularly as a woman. And certainly we all knew, just no one talked about it because she was black, like, you know, and other Aboriginal people all knew that we were Aboriginal. Like, it was an unspoken thing, but we all knew. But it was shameful for her for years. So it was, I guess it was really the fact that she connected to all these other really strong activists in our house, like my mum's friends and aunties, the people that I would call my aunties, and, you know, all these things that we'd be talking about around our dining table, you know, she would be there listening, but she didn't talk a lot about her childhood there were things that she, you know, you'd ask her questions and she'd say none of your business. She also happened to be the person I think that I inherited my sense of humour from. She was the funniest person I know and possibly one of the rudest. And growing up in a big Aboriginal community, that's a really common thing for us to have, like, nans who are the ones that teach us how to swear. Like, or just have these really cutting wits. One of the things that we discovered, we'd always thought that she'd been removed, but we were actually able, because there's no birth certificate, we were actually able to confirm who her mother was, but we haven't been able to confirm who her father was. We really struggled to find information, and, you know, I think it was probably pretty painful for her. So, yeah, she really didn't. She kept a lot of secrets, that woman. So I feel like my grandmother and also my mum were disconnected from opportunities to practice sort of traditional crafts, like Aboriginal traditional crafts. But what they did do was they excelled in a lot of white crafts like knitting and sewing. And my mum was also a painter. And certainly being an artist and a creative is something that not only ran through my matriarchal line, but in my whole family. You know, my mum, when we lived in the public housing, she had painted this mural of this forest, which is near where she grew up, you know, the mountain ash. And it was like a mural in our hallway that had this Aboriginal woman running naked, you know, like, and that was my play environment, particularly as a kid, and I didn't know it at the time, but I know now that I was autistic. And so that was my safe space, and so was our linen cupboard, which was in the same area. So, you know, I grew up drawing and painting and watching my mum draw and paint. I've been really fortunate in that I have built relationships with other Aboriginal women, and certainly then through starting an Aboriginal women's arts collective called Ngarrindjeri Kalatmimini with older Aboriginal women, I've got aunties and mums and, you know, who are teaching me traditional weaving and, you know, possum skin cloak making and net making. And, you know, I've got all these other mums because, like, sorry, I can get a little bit emotional, but my mum died at 59. You know, she was young, you know, and like a lot of Aboriginal people, I've lost a lot of family members. So, I'm really fortunate to have some of the best masters of their practices teach me and share with me. So I guess with my beanie, it is about really identifying myself as, you know, I'm Aboriginal and I'm proud of it. This is my badge of pride, and I wear it with pride.
Well, my name is Norm Bashara. I do massage. I'm called the massage guy sometimes a bone guy, sometimes other things. I've been in Creswick 23 years. My item, it's a rocking horse. Well, it's a racehorse on a counterweight. The back legs of the rocking horse, they sit on the edge of a table, and you only have to tip it one way and the head rocks, the arms rock of the jockey. It's a painted jockey. It's terribly badly done. It's a very crude cutout of a horse. But this little crude piece of work has followed me around. I'm trying to pinpoint it to an actual year. It was approximately 1989, and I've fancied myself. I was in a totally different space in those days. At the time, I was renovating furniture and I used to go to auctions. And I picked this item up because no one else wanted it. And I was the last bidder, the only bidder, and I got it for a dollar. And it sat in this box in my shed for so long until I offloaded the box, but I saw this racehorse. And I thought, oh, I'll just bring it out. It's sort of a bit of kitsch. You don't see many of them. It's unusual. I thought I'll bring it inside and let it be unusual on my mantelpiece at the time. It's a kind of a conversation piece. People always want to know where I get it from. It's just a thing I picked up, a bit of rubbish actually. But this bit of rubbish has followed me around for the last 37 years. And it reminds me of a time when I was evolving from renovating furniture 4 or 5 years ago as a hobby, and where I was in my head then, where I was physically, emotionally, and it just takes me back to a time in my life where I was still the same person, still had the same ideals as I do now, but I was different, quite different. And it's a memory, and it sparks memories for me. I had very few toys growing up, very few. I was one of 8 kids and toys were thin on the ground, and when they were there, they were demolished. And if I did get a toy, my older siblings would get hold of it and destroy it or do something with it, but it was not often returned to me in one piece. So my mum and dad didn't really give me toys as such, no. We were kind of toyless. My sisters had dolls. There was dolls and prams around. I can remember that. I can remember a scooter that was kind of communal. I remember a skateboard. Other than that, I never really had toys. My relationship to possessions in general, they really are just things. So I have a house full of possessions only because I've lived long enough to acquire them and not bothered to offload, but they're still just things. If I was to have a house fire and I had to run around and collect things, I don't know what I'd grab first. The dog first. I have 2 valuable pool cues, and they say, well, they're dumb old pool cues, but they are very expensive. But they are also what I would call my tools in trade at this present time in my life. I play an awful lot of snooker. I play an awful lot of pool. I love my cues. Yes, I'd grab them. And I'm not sure whether this horse would enter into my thinking. You know, it's a possession, but it's a memory as well, and it sparks. For me, it sparks memories of my past. It's part of, it was there with my history as I lived till this day, but not necessarily prized in that way.
My name is Eve Holmes, and I've lived in Creswick for about 14 years now. I was born in 1938, but that was in Estonia, which is a long way from here. We moved here having lived in Ballarat for a little while, and I love Creswick. I love the size of it. I love all the people here. I haven't met a nasty person. Unbelievable, but I haven't. The object that I've chosen is what I call the totem pole, even though that doesn't really describe it properly. It's a tall piece of cloth, about 6 feet tall, and it's surrounded by a piece of fabric that was flat to begin with, but now has a whole lot of things sewn over it. Well, I was born in Estonia, which is the northernmost of the three Baltic states. The country is very flat. I speak now as an Estonian for a bit. We can't defend ourselves. We've been invaded by the Danes, by the Germans, by the Russians. So I guess you'd have to say we're a hardy lot because we survive. My parents were divorced when I was very young. So I was with my mother, and I remember her saying, well, if the Russians are coming in again, we're going, because I remember the last time and I don't want to be here when that happens. So we actually left on the last German troop ship, which was interesting because as we were leaving the harbour, there was this little trail of something whizzing around and white that just missed the boat by about 10 inches. As a child, I didn't recognize what it was. But now I shudder every time I think of it. It was a torpedo. We were very lucky. The adults who were all standing on the deck watching this thing come at us and then go on past the boat, well, there's a fantastic sigh of relief because we knew we were safe, at least for a few minutes more, and we might actually get away. My parents had divorced just shortly before we left, and my mother and I, we'd escaped to Germany, which is what we did. And it was interesting, they landed us at Danzig, which is very close to the German border. I didn't meet any unkind people in Germany at that stage at all. We were let off the boat near Dresden, and that was all just rubble. There was a strange smell. It was quite horrible. My mother, they decided that she had to go and work in a munitions factory. Anyhow, we were then billeted by the powers that be in Borvenden, and the idea was that I would be housed at this lady's place while my mother had to go further out of town and work at a munitions factory making bombs, which I didn't quite understand at the time. And it's just as well, because I think I would have been frightened all the time. And she was such a lovely lady. You wouldn't expect, but she was so kind and so loving. And it was one of the best memories I have of that part of being in Germany. I think she must have had a son who was killed in the war, because she had this box that she gave me to play with, which was full of, you know, army rank ribbons of different kinds, which was rather strange, but I enjoyed the colours. I think her showing me these ribbons that her son had perhaps woke in me my love of colour, because there were such wonderful colours, and from then on I've always been interested in playing with colours. I see a piece of fabric and it gives me ideas. I love colour, I love pattern, and I love playing with them. I tend to have the idea and then I start collecting stuff, and that can take years sometimes. I've always been interested in colour and textiles, so eventually the two of them had to get together, didn't they?
Hi, my name is Rhonda, and the object I have chosen for this project is my knitting needles. I love what they bring to me. There is a strange compulsion in the trance of knitting, how the wool slips through my fingers and how the needles click and slide, how soft thin strands become fabric as they connect, lock and drop, link and fall, in, around, under and out, five purl, five plain, repeat. Repeat. When I made a baby blanket for the daughter of an old friend, there lay within each stitch our shifting faces as we aged, 40 years of friendship on and off as our lives unfolded. We chose the colours together by phone, sending photos by text, rainbow coloured or plain, or maybe a soft daffodil yellow, like a warm spring day covering him in warm sunshine and clear skies. In, around, under and out, slip one, yarn over, pass, slip stitch over, five pearl, five plain, repeat, repeat. I remember imagining as my fingers leapt of her grandchild and the August winter into which he would be born, thoughts weaving in and out with each unfolding row. I thought about how each side must tuck tight into the sides of the pram and how it will look as the parents look down, seeing it nestled around a precious little face. I could see my old friend's smile. In, around, under and out, counting stitches, 4, 5, 6, 7, plain, 8, 9, 10, 11, pearl, making squares that alternated like a chessboard. The wool slides through my fingers, catching and connecting the soft hues of the variegated wool, and I see again the silvery snow of new-shorn fleece beneath the outer weather-brown-tipped coat it lay beneath, and I remember my childhood on the Mallee farm and the gentle creatures from which it came. I remember Mary that we reared as a lamb, her bleating cry as she was led onto the truck as we wept. On my father's farm, I remember how the sheep would balk at the open gates, skittering away from the darting nip of the sheepdog, ringed by windmilling arms and whooping and the multicoloured curses of the men at the sheep clustered at the entrance, refusing to budge. I remember the stumbling of bone hooves across floors stained black by the years, and here again, so clear in memory, the shearers, regular as a metronome, as if melded to the shearing plant that rumbled at their backs, and see again their graceful rise and sweep to the rhythm of its deafening roar. In, around, under and out, turn, knit, pearl, repeat, repeat. I smell the heavy musk of lanolin and sheep shit, the heavy grumble of shearers' talk at Smoko sprawled on the stumpy Hessian bales, their weary faces and their hands oddly soft and smooth from the lanolin as they reach for thick golden slabs of homemade fruitcake and gulp sweet black tea in tin mugs, 5 spoons of sugar, heaped tablespoons. I remember my sharp-tongued Aunt Kath on my grandmother's farm, the one they all called Crazy. I didn't think she was, just loud. She knitted bedspreads for everybody in the family. I think of her subtle choice of colours taken from the farm she lived on all her life. Spring green of the garden, earth brown of the paddocks, dry mustard of hard-pressed dirt, and pale grey of Lake Badiocadio clay. Kath would knit by the dim light of the stove, flashing needles reflecting light from the firebox. That's where she taught me the secret language of knitting. Knit one, yarn over, increase one, increasing one for the diagonal, in, around, under and out. Each stitch I created in peaceful solitude or in kitchens, living rooms, on holidays, surrounded by the lived life of familiar others, joined in time to make memories. Like family history, some members dropping away. When Crazy Kath died, she left a hole like a stitch dropped, a colour missing from the family fabric. The music of her needles silenced and the fabric torn, loss leaking into the future, silences and guilt. And I remember how her ute always smelled of sheep dip. I think of the code women knitted into woolies to send during the war that they all lived through, needles stitching messages onto fabric like ink or the chatter of a keyboard onto paper or invisibly through air in today's electronic reality, all still communicating secrets or love, sorrow or kindness, different ways of yarning and helping. Needles stitching scarves and beanies for the homeless, stitching of warmth for the stricken or the lost, stitching snatches of comfort, in, around, under and out, in, around, under and out. Sometimes we can't do much, but we can do this. And sometimes my needles call to me seductively, promising their particular timelessness, a place to escape into, disappear, freeing my busy mind to drift and rise in the dance between my fingers. The repetition, in, around, under and out, in, around, under and out, hands and needles and fibre as one. Like the shearer, I am trapped in a rhythm, like a heartbeat, disconnected from the outside world of things and others. Mind and body moving in mesmerising tandem to the tick, tick, tick of the needles. Awareness blurred, unable to stop. I need to turn the heating on. Dinner's cooking and there is a faint hit of burning. A door slams. Someone's come home. The cat whines to be fed, but my fingers do not stop. Just one more row. But then, row finished, needles down, and I rise from my Aunt Kath's blanket and return to the world. Each time I take these needles in hand, I know they will take me to a kingdom I can return to at any time. Not a big thing, but having a strange seductive value beyond the most complex and delicate rules of measurement. Knitting, definitely my drug of choice.
Hi, I'm Jim Quinn. I have an 18-year link with Creswick, visiting your local Feldenkrais master. But I have interests in part of Creswick's history, particularly to do with its Chinese village that was attached to the town. The item I picked provides a link to my personal and professional development. I first developed an interest in the Chinese in year 10, and I don't know for what reason. That morphed into a long history of teaching and reading about mainland China, and a particular interest that still I'm active in today of the Chinese miners in Ballarat from the 1850s. It's a small ceramic inkwell, possibly 300 years old, and I purchased it for two or three reasons. One, the aesthetic appeal of it, and secondly, it came from a collection of a famous mid-20th century sinologist called C.P. Fitzgerald, devoted his life to the study of China. Primarily, it appeals for the human links, to have something that you know was used probably by a Chinese scholar when he would have been sitting at his desk writing any probably amount of things to do with everyday life, but he may have been purely an artist. So it has an appeal from that point of view. I find it interesting that there were potters who would have been so skillful to be able to produce something that's so fine and refined. So the green is a little unusual. The other aspect to it is its crazing, which is, I assume, is a skill of the potter, that they're able to develop that extraordinary graze in it. In itself, to me, what it offers is a really important as a historian and understanding that you only occupy your space for a certain amount of time. The particular item has a history 200 or 300 years before I appeared on the face of the earth, and hopefully it'll be here for 200 or 300 years after. And I do, when I see it, I touch it, but it sits amongst a whole range of other objects. And it's a room that has a number of toys and that the grandchildren have access to. They've been introduced to everything in the room, and they've spent time winding clocks, playing with the carriage clocks, and they've been allowed access to all things on the shelves. Some things are under supervision, but each of the four boys have had the opportunity, and the oldest is seven, of actually picking this up and feeling it. I suppose what I have in mind is that nothing's denied them, and they're given access to and an understanding of worlds beyond computers.
My name's Loris Button, and I've lived in Creswick for just on 18 years now. We moved here because my daughter and her family live here, but after we came, I discovered that my great-great-grandfather and his family had lived here. He and three of their infant children are buried in the Creswick Cemetery. The object that I've chosen to talk about is a doll that belonged to my mother. She was born in 1921. And these particular dolls were made in Switzerland between 1921 and 1930. So I'm guessing she probably was given it in about the mid-20s. And so it's a small doll, and I'm going to talk in inches because that's what makes sense to me, about 6 to 8 inches tall. It's an articulated doll, so it's got a metal body and arms and legs, but they all come apart, they're ball joints, and they all come apart. And the head is made of a compound substance. I'm not quite sure. It's painted, but the rest of it's metal. It was played with by my mother and her two younger brothers, and subsequently by my three sisters and I. So it's missing both its hands, and it's missing the clown costume that it originally had. So it is kind of slightly disturbing to look at, but I grew up with it, so for me it just has fond memories of playing with it as a child. The doll itself is quite unusual. You don't see many of them about, and they're called Saba dolls. They were only made for a short period of time, perhaps less than 10 years. I think it probably hasn't got any clothes because it was played with by my mother's two younger brothers, and I certainly don't remember it ever having anything when I was a child, so it's the clothes are long gone. The doll itself is not a particularly girly type of doll, but that would fit with my mother, who wasn't a particularly frilly sort of person. I'm guessing we were brought up not to be particularly frilly either, really. Four girls, and yeah, I can't remember much in the way of frills. For me, it was just something. It was interesting to pull apart and put back together again. For me, it doesn't seem macabre, but I can see why it would to other people. For me, it's a precious object. We divided up the precious objects in my parents' house amongst my sisters and I. None of the others wanted the doll, but I did. So I chose it in preference to an ivory figurine. So people are fascinated by it, but slightly repelled by it at the same time. It is interesting to decide what objects, and I have a house full of objects, what objects are most important to me, and it has no intrinsic value, really. It's just a personal connection that gives it value to me. I suspect not to too many other people. The doll was a rainy day plaything, so the button tin, the photo box, and the doll were things that we played with on days when you couldn't be outside playing in the street, running around the creek, whatever. Indoor play when I was a child was, you know, rare days when the weather wasn't sufficiently good enough for you to be outdoors all day, because we often were. I grew up in Coburg and near the Merry Creek, and we lived in a short street that wasn't a through road, so being a post-war child, there was a whole team of us, and you'd be given sandwiches and off you'd go for the day in a team, possibly with the family dog, down to the creek, roaming everywhere. So I would never have let my daughter do the same thing. And I'm sure it's very rare these days, perhaps for some country children, but in the city it wouldn't happen anymore, I don't think. These days you definitely wouldn't let your children roam around places like the Merri Creek on their own. Even in my day, a couple of local children were drowned. The creek used to flood quite dramatically after heavy rain, and the water levels would rise very quickly. And apparently one of these girls fell in and the other one tried to save her. So they were possibly about eight or nine years old. So it was a shocking thing to everybody then, but it didn't stop us being allowed to wander around. We were just told to be careful. The doll itself, I think, is emblematic of my childhood, really. I'm not too sure where to from here for this doll. 10 years ago, I would have certainly said that my daughter wouldn't be interested in it, but as she's getting a bit older and her own children are growing up, I think she is more interested in the old things that we have and the history, and she'll inherit the painting of it as well.
My name's Tony Clark, and I've been in Creswick since the end of 2019. And I moved up here for my be closer to my family, and I've been coming up here all my life because this is where all my roots are. People will probably know me from the area. I'm the tall blind guy, so you can't miss the dog. But look, yeah, love living in Creswick. The item I've chosen for this particular project and why it's so important is, in fact, my phone. People have said, why is my most important object not the dog? He's so uber important, don't get me wrong. But my phone is something that I take everywhere. My phone is something that has actually opened the world to me in so many different ways. It does things like, if I get lost, I can find where I am. I love books. I lost my eyesight when I was diagnosed, I was 19, declared legally blind at 20, and I had a passion for reading books, just loved it. And that was stripped away from me, you know, throughout the time when I lost my sight. So my phone is in fact something where I can reconnect with that space. It allows me to participate in the workforce in an equal way, which is uber important. I can communicate with the world on it. You know, I use my phone by talking to it, you know, and actually does all the text for me. It goes from text to speech, and I can send it all hands free. I can travel overseas, know where I am, look up what I'm doing, where I'm going. And I think most people will take that sort of stuff for granted. But I can tell you, when you can't see and you're on the train and they're not announcing where it is, to be able to say, where am I? And it'll tell me where I am. It's actually an incredibly comforting and really, really important thing. So it in fact has, it's opened up the world to me and enabled me to participate in a much more equitable way. I'm 53 and I was diagnosed, as I mentioned, when I was 19. I mean, people are constantly amazed at what the technology is. I mean, my phone goes, I don't know, maybe, you know, it's probably about 50% faster normal speed. My laptop runs at 450 words a minute. People speed read at 350. So, you know, you can really process a lot of information and get, you know, really connected. I think that's one of the great things about a smartphone is there's always constantly new surprises and new technology and improvements that happen over time. And the way it connects with the house, you know, I never would have thought of, you know, we talked about home automation 10 years ago. Now I've got the house automated. It's fantastic. I'll just say something like DEFCON 1, all the doors close, a lock, all the garage, the front gate closes, the alarm system goes on, all the lights turn off, because that was a big issue for me. Is when I was living by myself, I didn't know if the lights were on or off. There's no clues. I'd actually go around and touch the light bulb and go, is it on? Is it, it's hot, yeah, but yeah, I just turn it off. I've got no, especially on those switches on two ends, you know, you don't know with up or down, it's on or off. Yeah, so that sort of tech, yeah, I do that all on my phone. And it's just so good. And I can work out, is the gate open or closed? And it'll tell me, as opposed to me, you have to walk up to the gate and physically touch it to understand, is that what the case is? One of the great things, it's about the community involvement. I mean, it is that broader connection, family, community. I'm involved in the local scout group. And when you deal with youth, if you don't have a phone, you've got no way to talk to them. I think that the last thing I would ever, you know, I'd really emphasise to people is if you find somebody's phone, give it back. I had a phone stolen out of the train once. I unfortunately left it in the loo on the train and somebody took it, and they would have heard it talking and everything else. It's just such a, it's pretty horrible. when you sort of you lose that. It's not that you're dependent, and yeah, look, I was okay, but it's just a whole lot of hassle. So please, please give it back.
My name's Glenda Bryant. I live in Creswick. I've only lived here for less than a year and a half. Well, I was invited to be part of this and to bring along an item, but I just have so many items that are all special, I couldn't narrow it down to one. Most of them, the items I have with me, concern my father. My father was a very special man. We all have special ideas about our dad. He wasn't perfect, but he was certainly a gentleman. I always thought he was a big man, but actually he wasn't that tall, but he was very strong, very muscly, and just seemed to be able to do anything, and quite a good looking man in his prime. Yeah. I think I inherited my love of saving, collecting, hoarding from my parents. Dad was born in 1910, Mum in 1915. They were both from very large families, 10, 11 in each family. And they had to make do. And I think that's just how it was. And even when things were better in the 1950s and 60s, you never threw anything out. And everything just was very precious. So I think I got the bug from them. These two items belong to my father, a set square. It's metal, and then it's got a beautiful wooden part with a brass connection and a fold-out ruler, which Dad always said was very unusual because it's a 24-inch fold-out ruler. And he always seemed to have it in the pocket of his overalls. He always got around in dark blue yakka sort of overalls. I always remember him making things, building things. And he was very good at drawing and geometry, and he did welding and made swings and slides and things like that. When I hold these two items that belong to Dad, and I know that he did use them, they were everyday things for him. I don't know, it just makes me feel really happy and peaceful to look at them. So I guess to some people, I would be considered a hoarder, but not me, not by me. I feel quite happy when I have a cup of tea out of a nice fine bone china cup that I've sat and had cups of tea out of with Mum and Dad. It just makes me feel happy to be able to use things that have got meaning from old times. Preparing for this interview today, I did spend most of the day opening wardrobes and looking in boxes and thinking, come on, Glenda, you really need to make a start on this. And getting down some history onto the page for my children. I'm not sure what's going to happen to all the stuff I've collected. Not sure that either of my daughters wants to take it on. I guess a lot of it will be disposed of, but I won't be here. I don't have to worry about it.
I'm Neville Holmes. The object that I've chosen to talk about was made for me by my wife when I was seconded in the 1980s to the New South Wales Institute of Technology, where I was given an office. Now, this is something I never had before. I'd always worked in areas where with all sorts of people doing similar work and that sort of thing. So I had these walls to put things on. Eve made these wonderful pattern things there, the hanging things, to go on the wall of my office where I was, what, 2 years, I think it was there. They're kind of historical, so every one of them has some sort of connection with my life. And, for example, there's a little flag of Estonia there. And there are other things as well. There's a symbol for the engineering school at Melbourne University and a lot of other things. They're just different aspects, like, for example, there's a lion on it. because I'm a Leo. But a lot of them are where we've been and that sort of thing. So we just delight in being here, and we plan to keep going for as long as we can. And we have no plan of shifting out of the place.
My name is Natasha Middleton, and my object is the last pair of ballet shoes I wore as a professional dancer. I had a long career which spanned many decades, and I danced in every company in Australia, pretty much every ballet company, and in Europe I guested with several companies as a principal and was principal dancer with London City Ballet, and we toured all over Europe. Yeah, I was very privileged. My career flowed without me realising how lucky I was to be what they call headhunted now and asked to join companies. In fact, I don't really recall ever doing a proper audition. So I came to Creswick during COVID, right at the beginning of COVID, and I was commuting into Melbourne, teaching ballet and working with Seeing Eye Dogs, actually. And these ballet shoes, for some reason, have just been sitting in a cupboard in my lounge room, which was the cupboard I used when I was teaching ballet online. And every now and again, I get them out, and my feet have expanded about 4 shoe sizes since I stopped wearing point shoes. But every now and again, I get those shoes out and I squeeze my feet into them like Cinderella's ugly sisters and stand on point, and it just feels so beautiful. I can't explain how hard it is to let go of something that has been such a big part of your life, and it will bring me to tears because I haven't really felt that euphoria since. I don't live in the past, but that time was so precious to me, and there was a particular time where my dancing partner and I were principals with the West Australian Ballet, and we were the muses of the artistic director of that time, Barry Moreland. And we created so many full-length works and got to express so many emotions and dance together to music, hearing that beautiful sound, wearing the beautiful costumes, seeing all the colours and the lighting and the feel of the, if they use dry ice or smoke or haze, you feel that on your skin and you feel the air brush past your skin as you move. So every sense is activated, and you're going through intense emotions. You're falling in love and you're getting tuberculosis and dying and coming back, and everything's going on there. You get to express this intense emotions, and then real life is just, oh, right, I've got to go shopping now. There's no food in the house. It's quite hard to come back to. When people think of ballet dancers, they think of them on point, which is what we do. And a lot of people don't enjoy point shoes. I loved them. I felt tall, I felt elegant, sensual. I could turn faster. I was taller, my legs were longer. It felt like there was a whole new energy going through my body. Point shoes didn't hurt me. I mean, they probably were very painful, but you learn to cope. And people used to say that I was born in them, because of my flat feet. They weren't amazingly overarched feet, so they were strong. My feet were very strong. I could wear point shoes that were practically pulp and still dance in them. We learn as dancers how to manipulate our shoes to make them comfortable or useful, practical. We'd slice the sole, rasp it up so that it was rough and we couldn't slip. We used to darn our point shoes when I first started. My dad taught me how to darn. He was in the Navy, so he knew all that. We would slice the inside of the sole out so that, and I used to do it so that I could feel it pushing into the arch of my foot, and I felt that kind of connection to my shoe. We used to put paint in the end of our shoes, or shellac, which is a mixture of rosin and methylated spirits, and then we'd steam our shoes at the end of the night and push them back into shape. You either like to wear old shoes or you like to wear new shoes, or you find your favourites. But I would try and make my shoes last as long as I could if I had a pair that I loved. So I would, after a performance, when everyone else had left, I would still be there. I would have warmed down, stretched out, gone into the dressing room, taken off my makeup, and then started dealing with my shoes to get them ready, work out what shoes I was going to wear for what tomorrow night, get them ready. And, you know, I'd write little notes on the back of my shoes that you couldn't see from the audience. There is a lot of discipline being a ballerina. You give up your life for it, really, although it is your life. Yeah, your whole day when you wake up is about, if there's a performance on, it's about getting ready for that performance. And I think I still, I've discovered lately that I get this anxiety if I have, when I have to work over night time, because I get the same anxiety that I had going, oh, I've got a performance tonight. And you can't relax. It's like, oh, I've got to keep, I don't want to peak too soon. There were periods in months where you just go, this is my life now for months. This is my whole focus. And I don't know that everyone has that discipline, but I did. And most people that get to a certain level will have that discipline. It's been wonderful to be part of the team organising this project. I was interested and I knew my point shoes were going to be part of my story. Everyone has a story. It's been powerful to hear these stories of the significant objects that have inspired them. Perhaps it's even been cathartic for some of us. And I believe that sharing these stories has helped create a stronger bond amongst us. And it's a real reminder of how unique and vibrant this small community of Creswick really is.